Bhadram karne vishrinu yamate vaha Bhadram pashye makshabhir yajatraha Stirairangai istushtu vagum sastanubihi Vyashema devahitam yadayuhu Swastina indro vrutashravaha Swastina pusha vishwavedaha Swastina starakshu arishtanemihi Swastino brahaspatir tatatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
We're in verse 3 of the section. Dhanurgrahitva. Dhanurgrahitva Upanishadam. Dhanurgrahitva Upanishadam Mahastram. Dhanurgrahitva Upanishadam Mahastram. Sharam Yupasa Nishitam. Santadita Sharam Hupasa Nishitam Santadita. I think you all have a different version, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh well, it means the same thing. Santadita Ayamya Tadbhavagatena Tadbhavagatena Chetasa Laksham Tadevaksharam Lakshyam Tadevaksharam Somya Viddhi Somya Viddhi. Danuhu Grahitva Upanishadam Mahastram Sharam Hi Upasa Nishitam Sandadita Ayamya Tat Bhava Gatena Chetasa Lakshyam Tat Eva Aksharam Somya Vibdhi. This verse is introducing the Omkara, you know, the syllable Om, it's called Pranava, the syllable Om, as a different Upaya, means a different method for helping you recognize the nature of the self. It's a different methodology, and you'll find as we move through the Upanishads, through any Upanishad, it'll try one way, one type of enfoldment, then another type of enfoldment, then another type of enfoldment. In these two verses, they're unfolding the nature of Om, and how to sit with that syllable Om, as a symbol, and how to meditate on that in such a way as to help you recognize the nature of yourself. And so that's what this verse is about. So I noticed in Swamiji's commentary, he spent a few pages introducing exactly what is the Omkara before getting into these two verses that tell you exactly how to use the Om as a symbol for meditation, for what we call Upasana. So I'll tell you a few things about this sacred syllable Om, which really in India, Om is something that will start almost every chant that you do, like Om Namah Shivaya. Any prayer that you do will start with Om. Any auspicious event will always start with Om. And so also you can chant Om just in by itself. So let me tell you exactly what Om is. Linguistically or etymologically, it means, in fact, I didn't know all of this until I read Swamiji's commentary. Definitely, but it's really nice. Avati Rakshati Iti Om. Avati means that which protects, Rakshati. So that the one that protects, that which blesses. So this, the Omkara, Omkara means the sacred syllable, the kara, the letter, the syllable Om, so the Omkara. This Omkara means that which blesses, that which protects you. And it's formed like this. If you take the root of, for avati, that T avati, third person singular, he or she protects. So avati, if you take the root of, and add on this affix, mun, and you have of plus mun. When that happens, the of is changed. These are all Panini sutras. There'll actually be a whole list of grammatical aphorisms that explain all of this to you. When the suffix mun is added on to the root of takes a long oo. So now we have oo mun. But mun causes guna. For some of you won't know what we're talking about here. Sorry. The mun causes gunation of the root. So the oo, the of which has now become oo, will become o, omun. So now we have omun. But then the un of the mun is dropped. Right? There's another sutra for that. So you end up with om. That's how you get that. And so om means just as a word, just as the word, it means that which blesses you, that which holds you, that which protects you. So now, how do the Vedas, how is om unfolded? How do we understand om as a symbol? Because om is looked upon as a symbol, or actually the name for Ishvara. Right? So that means in this letter, in this symbol, om, all that is contained. Because Ishvara as the Lord is the whole. That which is, this conscious being which is the whole, is what we call Ishvara, the Lord. And so om, as a name for Ishvara, has to somehow, how do you make this om as a symbol, be representative or bring to mind Ishvara as the whole. So it's looked at like this. The first sound that you make as a human being, if you just open your mouth and make a sound, is ah. Right? The final sound you can make is if you close your mouth, mm. Right? So you have ah and mm. First sound and the last sound in terms of the whole vocal system. And so Swamiji had a nice little, he mentioned something, you know, in India, the name for mother is Amma. Amma. Because that would be naturally the first sound that a child could make. Ours is mama. We always do everything backwards. Amma, mama. Okay. But if you look at it, Amma, right? Ah and ma. The letter O is a diphthong that's made of the two letters A and U. So, A, U, M, right? So, the letter A is viewed as the first sound out of which all sounds come. Because if you have this initial sound, A, right, then everything is a manipulation of that sound. It's because by manipulating the voice box, I'm manipulating that pure sound. So, A, E, U, etc. Right? So, the pure sound is A, but from that A, everything comes. So the ah is representative of the entire manifest creation as a name, right? Names are names of things, right? And names will bring to mind things. Like, for just to make you understand this, if I say to you now, I give you a sound, a name, a word, like pot. When I say that word to you, the word will manifest into your mind the actual object that accompanies that word, right? And so here now, think of the letter A to be the sound symbol for the entire manifest creation that we perceive through our sense organs. The letter U, which is in between A and M, is considered to represent the whole subtle realm, the imaginative realm, the realm of dream, the realm of thought, emotion, sensation, imagination, which is not generated by sense perception. In other words, if I have a dream, those images that I'm receiving are not being received through my sense organs. So that's the room, that's the realm of dream, or the fantasy life, or those memories or whatnot that are not tied to your sense perception. Okay, so that's the U. And the M is considered the avyekta, or the causal, right? When the sound is withdrawn. Right? So now if you say Om, right, you have the manifestation that includes the U, which is the subtle. So you have the physical, you have the A, the subtle with the U, and then the withdrawal, the avyekta, the unmanifest with the M. Okay? So much for the creation. So now, but now, when I say Om, the symbol is actually coming from silence, obtaining in silence, and resolving into silence. You see that? If I say Om, 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 so the Om comes from silence and resolves into silence. Right? That silence is Brahman. That's considered what we call the Turiya, the fourth quarter. Right? That fourth quarter is the very being. It's not really a fourth or upright. It's the very being from which the Om rises and sets. The Om comes into manifestation, is there, and then resolves. Comes into manifestation, is there, and resolves. In the vision, we look at Ishvara as being Brahman, which then has a manifestation of knowledge, which is in the entire creation. So there's Brahman, the manifestation of knowledge, the sustaining of that knowledge, of that manifestation in the form of the creation, and resolution. Manifestation, resolution. Manifestation, resolution. When the creation is resolved, there is just Brahman as just the pure consciousness, which is the very being of that manifestation. But between the manifestation, there is no manifestation, right? So like that, when you say Om, 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 between the manifestation, there is no manifestation. But then what we also notice as we chant that mantra, the mantra Om, as we're chanting it, the Om is actually, it's not as though there's Om, silence. Om, silence. What we learn when we do the japa is actually there is silence, you know, there is silence from which the Om comes, which sustains the Om, and into which the Om sets. And so the silence is not displaced by sound. Even now, as I'm talking, the talking, the words that you're hearing are taking place in silence. You see that? In your own experience, the words that you're hearing right now are taking place in silence. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to hear the sound. There'd be too much noise. The sounds would be taking place in noise, not in silence, and so therefore you couldn't hear them. And so all sound takes place in silence. But now we normally aren't aware of that. That the sound rises from silence, is sustained by silence, and sits in silence. If that is so, the silence itself is not an object, because nothing is displacing it. Right? Nothing displaces it. So actually, the nature of the silence is awareness itself. The silence that cannot be displaced. So now look. If we want to contrast sound and silence, you can. Om, silence. Om, silence. Om, silence. Om, silence. But what about the silence in which the Om, silence, Om, silence, Om, silence is taking place? That silence is not objectifiable. And it is the very being of the sound, which the sound doesn't displace. See that? And so here, if you see that in reference to Om, and if you understand even now as we're talking that there's a silence that is not being displaced by the sound, then you need to let your mind put more focus on the silence that's not being displaced. What is the nature of that silence? The silence that's not being displaced. That's the nature of yourself. The silence that is never displaced. The silence. If I say that is the nature of yourself, you mean I'm just kind of some inert silence? I would say like this. Does awareness make noise? Is awareness noisy? Is the conscious being that you are noisy? Or does it illumine noise? I could say it illumines noise. consciousness illumines noise, consciousness is not noise. So then would we say that consciousness is silence? Well, you can say consciousness is itself silence, or consciousness is the very being which is the self of noise. Did I say that? Consciousness is the silent being which is the very self of noise. It's the very consciousness that illumines, or is the very substance of noise. But itself is not displaced by noise. And that is your own experience all of the time. We don't usually think of our experience like that. But here now, Om, this mantra, is being used to help us meditate as a technique, as a symbol, to help us do an upasana on Om. It's being used as a symbol for upasana, where the nature of Ishvara is packed into this letter Om, the symbol Om, so that when you say the Om, right, it brings to mind that whole reality and allows you to resolve yourself into that reality. So let's look at this verse a little bit, and then I'll say more about it. It says, Dhanur Grahitwa, having taken hold of the bow, like a bow and arrow, having taken hold of this bow, which is the great Shastra, it's actually a great Astra, which is itself a great weapon, Upanishadam, born of the Upanishads. This bow is a great Maha Astram. The bow, usually the arrow would be called the astra, because an astra is a weapon that can be thrown. But here this bow is the means for that arrow, so it also is being called an astra. So having taken hold of the bow, which is Upanishadam, born of the Upanishads, which itself is a great astra, Maha Astra, Mahastra. This Upanishadam, this astra, which is born of the Upanishads, is what is Om. So this verse is talking about Om. So this bow, imagine this bow. This bow has to be grasped by you. This bow, which is Om, has to be grasped by you. What that means is that the Om itself, what it is, has to be understood. Like to grasp, because it's not a physical bow, right? The bow is Om. And so to grasp this Om now means that you have to understand, you have to know what it means, right? So that when the word Om is said, it can do its job. Like if I say to you, if I say a word to you, like I use the word pot, or lamp, or rug, or apple, these words do their job, right? By bringing to mind what they are, the object itself. So now if I say the word Om, and that word is understood, the meaning is understood, then the mind is going to use this word Om as a bow, okay, on which it is going to launch the arrow of your mind. Okay, that's the next line. So having understood this bow, grahitwa means having grasped, so we're looking at this, having understood it, what it is, how to use it, and what it means. Having understood it, the shavan, the arrow, upasa nishitam sandhati. One should sandhati, you have sandhati or something like that in your book. Sandhati is the sandhita, is the participle form. Having properly placed the arrow which has been sharpened through upasana, through meditation. So now the arrow is what? The arrow is your mind. So having placed your mind, the arrow, which is your mind, that has been now sharpened through meditation, on this bow, on the bow of the Upanishads, then what? Ayamya. Then, having pulled the string, tadbhavagatena chetasa, with a mind that has assumed, that has taken on the very nature of that Om. Says, tadbhavagatena chetasa, having pulled, with a mind now that has become, taken on the very being, is assume the very being of that. One should then pierce Lakshyam Tadeva Aksharam Saksomya Vidhi. One should then pierce the target, right? One should then pierce the target, Tadeva Aksharam, which is that imperishable one. The Aksharam all the way through the Upanishad has been like, is a name for Brahman. So one should, hey Soumya, oh dear one. So the student, the teacher is talking to the teachers, oh dear one. One should then, you know, pierce, let that arrow pierce the Akshara, that very Akshara, which is the target, which is Brahman. Then the next verse it's going to say a little bit more about this, but let's look at it. It's really using an image to talk about Nididhyasana, to talk about meditation or even Vipassana, the repetition of a mantra, in this case the mantra Om. So now, yourself, the conscious being that you are, is normally identified with the upadhi. This comes from now Shankara's commentary on this. The Atma, the self that you are, is identified with the upadhi, with the mind, right? So now this conscious, the mind, the conscious mind, which has for its very being the Atma, the self, that conscious, that mind, takes itself normally, the upadhi, to be that Atma, right? And so now this mind, your mind, is starting to recognize, is starting to learn that the self, that its very self, the very self of the mind, the very being of the mind is starting to recognize that the very being of the mind is, in a sense, independent of the mind. In the sense that the mind is not independent of the self. In other words, you can't imagine your mind being unconscious or away from consciousness, right? But the conscious being that the mind enjoys is not dependent on the mind, because the mind is something that continually changes and comes and goes and changes in its nature and changes in its form continually, right? And the mind is also something that you can resolve. In fact, you can stop the thought flow. You can change the quality of the mind. But one thing that you can't change in terms of the quality of the mind or the nature of the mind is the very conscious being that the mind enjoys, that allows the mind to say, I am the mind. Right? The mind says, I'm the mind that says, I am the self in me. That mind says, I am the self. And no matter what the mind is thinking or feeling or doing, that self is always there as its very core, as its very being. And so you can have the mind assuming any number of different moods or emotions, right? And those moods and emotions, feelings, perceptions are continually negating each other, right? You don't have one perception, doesn't stay there, it's always replaced by another. You don't have one mood, it's always replaced by another. But in the experience, integral to the experience of all of these changing moods and perceptions, is you, the conscious being that the mind takes to be itself. But what needs to be recognized, what that mind needs to recognize, is the conscious being that the mind has taken to be itself never changes as the mind changes. It is stable. The conscious self, the very presence, the very me, the very self of the mind, is, yes, the very self of the mind as much as the clay is the self of the pot, right? You know, the pot has no being whatsoever away from the clay. Your mind has no being whatsoever apart from you, the conscious self that you are. But there's a difference in terms of order of reality. And the difference is this, that the conscious being that you are is the stable presence that never changes, and the mind, which totally enjoys it as much as the pot enjoys the clay, is always changing and coming and going. This differentiation has to be made. this meditation is a device to help you make this differentiation. So what is it asking you to do? It's asking the mind to string itself on the bow of Om. And so now that means that this mind has to assume the form, the thought modification, the form of Om, of which you know what that means. You know the meaning of Om. Is a name for Ishvara. So now the mind, assuming that form of Om, right, being lodging itself on Om, being sharpened by meditation, what does that mean? You can't assume the mantra Om, for instance, Om, Om, Om. Your mind can't do that unless it's ready for that. Because what'll happen? Om. Yeah, but I have to do such and such. yeah, but what about, what's that going to do? Yeah. And then pretty soon you're out somewhere, okay? That mind's not sharpened by upasana, right? It can't hold itself, okay? So a mind that's been sharpened by upasana, by meditation, or by vairagya, actually, by dispassion, by mumukshutvam, you know, that desire for liberation, okay, that mind is really available. So now this says, a mind which is available, let it, you know, mount, right, this bow of Om. So what does it mean? The mind itself has assumed Om and I'm focused on it. So now I can say this. I can go Om, Om, and my whole focus can be on that, Om. Okay. Now it says, having mounted, having focused on the Om, I draw the string of that bow, right? It says, Ayanya, I draw the string of that bow, which is now, what does it mean? With a mind, right, that has totally focused itself on the meaning of Om, on what Om means. So now I'm saying Om, and now I'm focused exactly on the meaning of that word. And focusing on the meaning, the essence of that word, I let the mind go into it. I let the mind go into the meaning of the word. So what does that mean experientially? If I say Om, and the Om resolves Om, into the silence, right? The Om is resolving into the stable being of myself, which it recognizes as Ishvara. Right? Now look at with Om. So let me make that clear again. If I know that Om is Aum, and it stands, it's a name for Ishvara, for the whole. And if I understand that this creation, Ishvara, the whole of what is, the creation manifests and resolves into the self which is limitless. Okay? That self which is limitless is my own being. What this does now is when I recognize that, the mind says Om, right? The mind says Om, I recognize this as addressing my being as infinite. Remember, the Atma is Brahman. Yourself is Brahman. Normally, the self is improperly identified with the physical body, right? Or the mind. Are you with me on this? I know I'm a little convoluted here, but anyway, I'm going to keep going until I get it right for you. The Atma, yourself, is the Atma, yourself, which is Brahman. Not like Brahman, the Atma that you are is Brahman. That Atma self is normally identified by the mind as belonging to it. That's what makes a jiva. Like, there is no jiva, really. What you think is a jiva is Brahman. There is no jiva. Right? So the self that you are is Brahman. The mind habitually takes that self that you are, that is the very self of the mind, to be itself. That is the problem. Then you become limited, right? Well, so you never have become limited, ever. You have never not been Ishvara. You have never not been Brahman. That is who you are. But the mind, because of beginningless ignorance, has a very strong identification with itself being yourself. Right? Whereas, in fact, itself has yourself for itself, but yourself is Brahman. Yourself is the one from whom the entire creation comes, of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. And like in this room, you're a part of the room, I'm a part of the room, the rug's a part of the room, the space is a part of the room. This whole thing is one manifestation, right? It's one manifestation of one being. In fact, I am the self of this, of which this is included. And my mind and sense organs all are included. That's the reality. But this mind, this individual mind, is different from this mind and this mind and this mind and this. That's also true. Right? This lamp is different from the table. I'm not trying to make the lamp into the table. I'm just saying that the being of the lamp is the being of the table. Right? That there's only one self here. And so now, when I say Om, what does that make me recognize? Oh, my being, right, is the one from whom this whole creation comes. I am the Atma that I am. I am the self of this creation. This creation comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. So when I say Om, what do I see? The silence of my being, that's my experience, the silence of my being, Om. And that Om stands for the manifestation of the creation. And then when the Om comes to an end, the resolution of the creation into the silence of my awareness. So I say Om, 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 Om. Every time the word Om, which is Ishvara, the name for Ishvara, resolves into the conscious being, which I am, which is Brahman. You see? So now your mind, what happens? Your mind becomes this bow, right? The Om is the Om is the very bow which your mind uses to resolve into the target of Brahman. That's the analogy, the metaphor that they're using. But if you look at it, that is exactly what is happening. Your mind takes on the bow of Om, and then that Om itself resolves into your being, which is now recognized as Brahman, because Om is the name for Ishvara. See how that goes? So if you, as you understand Ishvara, you understand the cyclical nature of this creation. When you say the word Om, and you know, understand that as the name for Ishvara, right? Then you have the manifestation and the resolution of the creation. Manifestation, resolution. Manifestation, resolution. In manifestation from what and into what? Into the silence of your being. Right? Into consciousness. The conscious being. If you say Om, where does it come from and what does it resolve into? You see, your mind's not saying anything else. That's why this upasa nishitam is sharpened by upasana. So there's nothing else going on in your mind. So you say Om. It comes from where? From you. Does everybody see that? The Om comes from you, the conscious being that is you. Where does it go back? To you. That you is Brahman. That is Brahman. And so now the mind has assumed the form of Ishvara, the name of Ishvara, right, as a symbol. So it's loaded itself on the symbol, the name for Ishvara. And so your mind then is in the form of Om. Going manifesting and resolving, manifesting and resolving into what?
Me.
Me. Who is the me? Brahman. The me that you are is Brahman. Anyway, it's not becoming Brahman, you're not creating Brahman, you're not imagining Brahman. Right? But the problem is not that you have to become Brahman. The problem is that you are Brahman, and the mind, because of ignorance, has not recognized that fact. There's no problem in reality. But that doesn't mean there's not a problem. There's really not a problem, but that doesn't mean there's not a problem. There is a problem, because ignorance causes a problem. It causes suffering. It causes me to suffer. It causes me as a jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, to knock around in this creation in a way that is excruciatingly painful. Right? Because I'm looking for myself everywhere. You know? Trying to become whole, trying to find myself, trying to complete myself. Looking out in this world, where in fact the wholeness is the very being of the world, not the objects that I'm looking at. It's the very substance that I am. And the substance that I am is the substance of all that is, in fact. But it's not something I can look at. I can't say, oh, look at Brahman. I can only be Brahman. Right? I can't look at Brahman. I can look at Brahman in this way. I can say, this is Brahman, and this is Brahman, and this is Brahman, and this is Brahman, and this is Brahman. But I'm not seeing Brahman, I am being Brahman. Right? What I'm seeing are the names and forms. Right? I'm seeing all of the names and forms. I'm seeing a manifestation of knowledge, which I myself, as a body, mind, sense organs, are part of that manifestation of knowledge. I'll give you an example. If I have a dream, for instance, that you can look at that dream, or if I ask you to have an imagination of a meadow or something, I'm saying that's a manifestation of knowledge. Like all of it. None of it is away from you in any way. There's nothing there but you, in fact. Because you can't take that manifestation, that say that dream image, you can't take a part of it and say, oh, let me put this part over here, as though it has any substance away from the being that it is. You know, can you imagine that? Say you have a Say I ask you to, you know, close your eyes and imagine a meadow, and then here you are, you're imagining a meadow, and you say, well, let me set part of the meadow over here, you know, away from me. Can you do it? Let's divide this meadow in half, and I'll put half on this side and half on this side. You know? Can you in any way get your hands on the meadow, get your hands on the imagination, get your hands on the dream, away from your own being? And there's nothing there. Is it like trying, kind of like trying to, you know, let's take the pot and put the pot here and put the clay here. You know? So let's take my thought, let's take the image, let's take the manifestation of knowledge and put it in a shelf. Maybe I'll collect them. Okay, collect books. I'll collect my manifestations of knowledge. It isn't there. There is no such reality at all. There's not two here, right? And then you try, say, the given manifestation of knowledge, which has all of these parts, can you take part of it out? And let's take this part out and just have a little hole there. It is impossible. There is no duality in that way. There's no duality in that way. You can't find something here that has any being separate from being itself. Now I'm talking to you, or I was just talking in terms of, say, your imagination, or in terms of a dream, so that you can really, really feel, understand that. So now, what's happening is with this using Om, using this letter Om, you can load on to the word Om now, the symbol Om. You can load Ishwara onto the symbols. You're loading it. That's what makes it a symbol for Upasana. You understand the you understand it as a word for the Lord, for Ishwara, for the whole. And then loading it with that knowledge, then when you say that word Om, right, you've loaded the word Om with your knowledge. That's the grahitwa, having grasped it as this bow. Then you load your mind onto it, and you let that Om resolve right into Brahman. Yours resolve into yourself as Brahman. Right? Yourself is Brahman, but your mind needs to resolve into the self as Brahman. Right? It needs to recognize that fact. Right now, your mind, until it's otherwise, recognizes yourself as itself. Your mind recognizes yourself as, I am this person sitting here, me. Me is this body. Me, this me, I am this mind. I am this body mind. I need to recognize, no, I, the same I that I've taken to be this body mind, no, this I is Brahman. This I, this me, which is the very being of this body and mind, it is this me that is Brahman. It is this me that is Ishvara, the one from which the whole comes. So now, this Om is being used as a meditative device to understand that. So let's do this next verse because it completes it. It's still on the Om. Pranavo tanuhu, shirojatma. Brahmata laksham uchate, brahmata laksham uchate, apramatena vetavyam, apramatena vetavyam, sharavatan mayo bhavet, sharavatan mayo bhavet. It repeats. Pranava is the name for Om. You usually don't say Om, you call it Om by the name Pranava, out of respect. Not sure what pranava means either, but it is a name for Om. So the pranava, the dhanahu, the pranava Om is the dhanu. Okay, pranava is the Om is the bow. Sharaha hi atma, the atma is the shara, is the arrow. Here by atma, what they mean is the atma as experienced through the upadi, right? The atma here, I am the atma, I am the self. Unfortunately, there's ignorance there. But I am the Atma. So the self that I am, this Atma with this mind, right? So it's really the guru talking about the mind because there's an identity there. So the arrow is the Atma. Brahma ta laksham uchate. Brahman is its target. Brahman is the target of that Atma. Okay? So then it says, apramatena vedavyam. That target has to be pierced with a mind that's not lazy. Apramatena means a mind that hasn't run off getting distracted with this, that, or the other thing. Right? So that mind, the atma, which is really taken by the mind to be itself, that mind, right, has to mount itself on Brahman, it has got to mount itself on Om. And then it says, let's see, pranavaha dhanuhu, sharaha hyatma, brahma ta lakshan uchate, apramatena vedavyam, sharava tanmayaha bhavet. That atma, which has mounted itself on Om and has Brahman for its target, that atma, like an arrow, has to become one with Brahman. So that's the image. How do I become one with Brahman? How do I become the being of Brahman? Right? Do I get myself glued on to Brahman? Right? Becoming one with the being with Brahman, for my being to become one with Brahman, is something that takes place only through knowledge. Right? It's only through the recognition that my being is infinite. That becoming one with Brahman, for the Atma, for the mind, you know, the Jiva, for the Jiva to become one with Brahman, is for the Jiva to recognize I am Brahman. Right? There is no other way. Something which is limited cannot become something which is limitless. Right? Something that exists as an object in time and is subject to time can't be become something which is free from time. And so the jiva, jiva means the soul, the transmigrating soul. The jiva, the person is the jiva. The one who says, I'm the transmigrating soul. You know? The one who says, I'm this person. The one who says, I'm this body. It is this one that has to recognize I am Brahman. Right? It's not this one has to become Brahman. It's not that this one has to travel to become Brahman. I have to recognize that I am Brahman. And that's not through memorization. You know, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman. You know? Nor is it a catechism. I am Brahman because the Bible tells me so. You know? This is part of a little song I used to learn when I was a little girl. I'm something because the Bible tells me so. I don't remember what it was. anyway, the point is, it's not a matter of teaching. It's not a matter of memorization, right? It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of recognition, because the reality is, you are here. The conscious being that you are is here. And the conscious being that you are is the one stable being that is. It's the one thing that never goes. The one thing that never changes, that never modifies, that can never be objectified, that can never be touched, that can never be changed in any way. And so this stable being needs to be recognized. And what are the implications of a being, your being, which is not objectifiable? Means it's not an object within the creation subject to change. If I recognize that the conscious silent being that I am is not objectifiable and not subject to time, not subject to change, what is the relationship of that being to this body, which is objectifiable, which is subject to birth and death, which is subject to change? What is my relationship to the mind, which is objectifiable, is subject to change, right? Is subject to ups and downs, to coming and going? What is my relationship to that? If something comes and goes and changes and I don't, what is the sangha? What is the attachment there to make me say that I am that? What is the attachment to the body if the body goes on changing and modifying and is objectified and I remain stable? What is the sangha? What's the attachment to make me say I am that? If I'm always constant, if my being is constant and changeless, and that is in fact my experience, I can differentiate the conscious being in all experience that I have as something which is immutable, which is a word we use for it. It's immutable. Right? How can I then take myself to be things that are mutating when I'm not? If I don't mutate when something else mutates, if I don't go when something else goes, how can I have a relationship with that where I'm affected by it? So you find, in fact, you are never affected by anything. That's not to say that your mind can't be sorrowful, or your body cannot, that your body's not in pain, or that the world is not falling apart in this way, or that it is. It is. Yeah. But are you? Is awareness falling apart? Is yourself falling apart? Your mind might be falling apart. Is yourself falling apart? Is consciousness falling apart? Or is consciousness the stable one that illumines the fallen mind that's falling apart? Is the body in pain? Yes. Is consciousness in pain? No. Because that doesn't mean that this body's not painful. But is consciousness painful? This is the differentiation that has to be made. If the conscious being that I am is not this body, and is not this mind, and is not these changing experiences, and the conscious being that you are is not this body and not this mind and not these changing experiences, right? Then what makes me different from you? And I'm using not in a different, in an odd way here. It's a very peculiar relationship. It's the relationship of not, this is not that. That language implies that there's two things. I'm not that. That mean that. I'm not that, like the pot isn't, like the clay isn't pot, isn't the pot. There's a very unique relationship between clay pot, which we call satyam and mithya, where one is dependent on the other, but it's not in the reverse. This is very important to understand your experience with all of the things that in this creation. If I look at the clay pot, the pot has no reality apart from clay. There's Advaita there. See that? Clay pot, Advaita. There's a clay and a pot. No. There's a clay. But there's a pot. There's a clay and a pot. But the pot has no being apart from the clay. The pot has, the order of reality we give to that pot is mithya. It has an apparent reality. It depends for its being on the clay. Right? Without the clay, it wouldn't be there at all. And really, the only thing that's there is clay. That's the situation we have here. The clay can say, I'm not the pot. It doesn't matter to me if the pot's there. There's only clay from the standpoint of the pot. There's a pot. It's just clay. I'm not dependent on the pot in any way. The clay can't say, oh, forget it. I don't need you either. Yeah? Clay says, I don't need the pot. I'm free of the pot completely. My being has no dependence on the pot whatsoever. Come and go as you like. The clay and the pot say, you come and go. No. No. It's not equal in that way. So we say that the clay is real. In terms of this, the clay is what is actually there. That's what is the thing. That is what is there. The pot is dependent for its thingness, for its being, for its substance on the clay. Here, when I say, I am not the form, I'm not the pot, my being, who I am, is not objectifiable, it's not something at all dependent on these forms, which are totally dependent upon me. You try to take these forms, remove these forms from being, remove these forms from existence, remove these forms from consciousness, you can't do it. But as long as these forms are here, they enjoy consciousness. But the forms go, I'm still here. I don't need the forms. I don't need the perceptions. I don't need the mind. I don't need the manifestation of knowledge. I don't need the manifestation. I am the being of the manifestation, but I don't need the manifestation. The dream can come and go. If it comes, if it's there, fine. If it's not there, fine. It totally depends on me for its being. I am its being. But I don't need it. This is what you have to realize in your own situation here. You don't come and go. Everything depends on you for its being. Right? But you don't depend on it. If you did, what would happen when it goes? Everything's just to think of your mind, your thoughts. Oh my God, that thought's going. Please don't go, don't go, don't go, don't go if you take me with you. That's not the case. You're the constant. You're the constant. And now, look at this. If I am the constant and these things are always changing, if these things can come and go and I remain steady, and it's the same for you and the same for you and the same for you, same for you, what is to differentiate us? What is to differentiate the conscious being that I am? To make me different from you? I'm not objectifiable as an object, like the bodies are all, different and part of this one manifestation of knowledge, all of different parts of one manifestation of knowledge, you could say. But what about me? Where do you start and where do you stop? What makes there two of us? Are there two non-objectifiable, changeless, conscious beings? which is the very self of even space and time. These are all, space and time are all objectifiable. So you see, this me, right? This me is the me, is the self, this conscious being that I am. It is the self from which this creation comes, sustains, and resolves. I am Brahman. It is this self that is Brahman. So when I say Om, right, my mind remembers that. My mind remembers because Om stands for this whole manifest creation. And I am the self of the whole manifest creation, not just the self of this body. So when you do this mantra, Om, Om, the mind, and you let the mind just be with that, then it continually resolves into yourself as one. Did you see that? That's how that mantra works.
Yeah.
Let's just take a minute.
Don't stop.
Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Sound problems. I don't know why. Oh, good. Dejan said it's been all right for her. That's good.
Oh, good.
Maybe it's just you, Rob. I hope not. You're gone now. Could have been bad. Oh, well.
Is this the only Upanishad where Om's kind of?
No, the whole Mandukya Upanishad is on Om. It's beautiful. Swamiji refers to it in his commentary. I hope everybody's reading the commentary. It's really a beautiful commentary. Yeah, the Mandukya Upanishad is on. The whole thing is on Om.
Mm.
I think there's other Upanishads that talk about it also.
I guess in terms of using mantra or japa, you could apply the same principle,
yes.
No matter which mantra you're, even if you're not using Om specifically.
That's right. In fact, you'll probably read this in Swamiji's Bhasha there. He's also talked about it in class, that if you haven't taken sannyasa and living the life of a renunciate, he say actually it's better not to just chant Om by itself. You know, because it will, it makes you just want to take sannyasa and not be involved in the world. And if you're if you're in the world with certain responsibilities, and it's not the best of the mantras to chant. So he suggested Om Namah Shivaya, which is one that we often chant. So it starts with Om, and for somebody who has knowledge, whenever you say Om, it brings to mind Ishwara, you know, and then Namah Shivaya, my salutations to Shiva. And Shiva is the one, you know, who resolves the creation or who removes ignorance. But the whole mantra is, you can look at it in the same. The Om Namah Shivaya rises from the silence and resolves into silence. It's just that when you say Om by itself, that's the name of Ishwara. And so it makes you think of Brahman manifesting as the creation and resolving. That's what the word Om brings to mind. You know, so that's.
And then the Namah Shivaya?
It's just Om Namah Shivaya means Namaha means salutations or my prostrations to Shiva, to the Lord in the form of Shiva, the one who removes ignorance.
So why is that one better to use if you don't want to be a sannyasi?
Because you're a mumuksha and you want to remove ignorance. But there's a lot of different mantras, not just one. Whatever mantra is close to you, then you use that mantra because it evokes the Lord, and it also, so in that evoking, the Lord puts you into a certain bhava, a certain attitude, you know, and then the mantra comes from silence and resolves into silence and leads you, and eventually the mantra drops off and you just abide in that silence.
In reference to the death of the physical body, I was following everything. And how I got to the death of the physical body.
Well, you know, let me use another example to what the death of the physical body. Well, so I'll use clay pot first. If you have a clay pot, you know, and I squash the pot into a plate, so I've got a lump of clay. A nice pot, make it into a nice pot. Now the pot has been born, right? And now I decide, I think I'll make it into a plate. Make it into a plate. The pot is gone. The plate has come. But nothing's happened to the clay. But the clay hasn't come into being or gone out of being in the confines of that. You see that? There's not been a birth or death for the clay, so there's been no such experience for the clay. Right? There's been a change in form, but there's been no change in substance. So what would the death experience be for the clay?
No change.
No.
I understand that conceptually. It's that the pure awareness remains.
Yeah.
No matter what the physical body is doing. The awareness of any kind of an I, personal I, with any continuum, I think must just disappear like
no.
Nothing.
No. That is exactly the thing. The personal I is Brahman. What you think is a personal I, it is a personal I, but there's only one person. It's a personal I, but there's only one person, and that one person is Brahman. Yeah. Yeah. So another way of I like to look at it is, you know, if, and say you go to sleep at night and you have a dream and you're a character in the dream, right? So there's a whole world and you're participating in that world and all these various things are happening and you're very involved in it. And the alarm goes off. And that world is gone. And you've been destroyed. The world has been destroyed. You've been destroyed. Whoever you were identified with, right? But what is the death experience? Nothing. Zero. Not anything. Because you are not objectifiable. You are the being itself, right, from which this manifestation of knowledge comes. And so there is no fluctuation or experience in being. While the dream is there, the being, as a manifestation of knowledge, which is not apart from that being, It's not like there's yourself and a manifestation of knowledge over here somewhere. Okay. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But when that manifestation is gone, what's happened to you? Absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
A good way to experiment with this is just to use your own mind as though your mind is Ishvara, you know? You're the conscious being and you have a thought. You have a thought of a meadow or the beach or some thought. And then resolve the thought. Have the thought again. Put yourself in the thought with friends walking along. You can get a complex imagination going. You, conscious, the conscious being, you are the reality of that thought. You're the very being of the thought. You can't remove yourself from the thought. But without the thought, you're still there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Completely.
Yeah.
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 So without ripple, without change at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now what you have to realize is you're there before that thought without a ripple, during the thought without a ripple, after the thought without a ripple. There's nothing happens to you ever. And no matter what the thought is, if it's a good thought, it's a bad thought, an emotional thought, a blissful thought, a sad thought, whatever the thought is, you're there before, during, and after without a ripple. There's no change in your self-experience. Even though these thoughts have their affect and content, you know, that's true. But your self-experience is not changing at all. So now the thing is, you know, you need to differentiate the changeless from the changing in every experience. And then you'll find that the changeless, you are the changeless. You have to recognize the changeless being that is totally the clay of the pot of the thought or the feeling or the experience. And it's hard to kind of pull it out. They use an example of a Hamsa bird coming to a, what do you call these, like a water
bird bath.
The Hamsa bird comes down and sits on this bird bath, which has a mixture of milk and water in it. Right? Somebody filled the bird bath with milk and a mixture of milk and water. And the Hamsa bird comes down and sucks out all the milk and leaves. Yeah.
Yawning.
So now here we are, right? Yeah, the Yanni bird. So now here we are. All this name and form, mood, emotion, sensory perception, emotions, all the things that are available in the samsara within duality, within this manifestation of knowledge. Yourself is the very being of that. Just like the clay is the being of the pot, you are the being of this intricate manifestation. Now, very intricate manifestation, because look around you, right? You are the changeless being that is pervasive, the very stuff of it. The mind, which is part of this intricate manifestation, needs to be able to differentiate itself and the manifestation from the being. One is the changeless, one is changing. One is the constant, one is the Maya. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's nice.
The one is not hidden ever by the other. You know, it's not like the Maya, the manifestation, puts a bag over the self and hides it, because you are the self, right? So nothing can, nothing, and you are pervasive to all others, so nothing can hide you, nothing can cover you. You are the very changeless being of everything. And so now, that's why you can't look for, you know, let me have an experience of the self. Let me have an experience. Looking for an experience. What if the pot were to say, oh, let me just have an experience of the clay. Let me have an experience of the clay. Looking, waiting for an experience. You already are that. You are the experience. It's not a matter of looking for an experience. It's a matter of recognizing. Right? The class, the pot has to recognize I'm in play. It can't look for another experience. It's not that the experience isn't there. It's there as my very being. That's why we say self-evident.
Well, if the mind of the jiva is part of Ishvara, and Ishvara doesn't have ignorance, then how does the mind have ignorance?
It's because we look at it like this. From Ishvara's standpoint, there's what we call the Maya Upadi. You know? But look like this. Ignorance, we say, has two capacities, avarna vikshepa, right? Avarna means ignorance covers. Like, for instance, if I mistake a rope for a snake, the ajnanam, the ignorance, covers the rope and allows for the projection of the snake. If I saw the rope, right, I couldn't see the snake. Now, look at our situation. From the standpoint of Ishvara, just as Atma, there's an infinite manifestation of knowledge. I am, as Ishvara, I am not an object within that manifestation. I am the being from whom the entire manifestation has come. That means the whole Maya, Upadi, is myself. There's no identification with anything within it. See that? I'm the whole. So for Ishvara, there's no avarana. There's no covering. There's only vikshepa. There's only the projection of Maya. But now look at the situation of everything within that manifestation of knowledge. All of the jivas, all of the individuals, okay? They're the same Maya, but they are within the manifestation looking around through sense perception. Limited body, limited mind, because my mind is different from you. I mean, I'm certainly not identified with the whole, and I'm experiencing the creation through the sense organs and through the mind. And so what is Maya for Ishvara is Ajnanam for the jiva. Right? Because the mind and the sense organs, by their nature, right, have no access to knowledge of the self. They just have for their being the self. But they're blinded, in a sense, because of the limitation of the upadi. So what is Maya for, we say like that, what is Maya for Ishvara is a jnanam for the jiva. Now the jiva can go throughout the creation gaining knowledge of objects in the creation through your sense organs and through the means of knowledge that we have available to us. So you're removing ignorance in that way by using the means of knowledge you have, your five sense organs and inference and presumption and all these things. But how is the jiva going to remove knowledge of who I am? With I am what I am, experientially I am me, but this mind, which is never away from me, the conscious being, is limited and identified with this body and looking out. And so how can this mind know that I am the conscious being from which the whole creation has come? That's the problem. Now look at, and if you can think of, it's so useful to think of the dream, because say you're having a lucid dream, you recognize you are the one from whom the whole dream has come. You're not identified with any part of it. Look at the situation of the dream character in the dream. But that, what is that poor thing going to do? It can look all around for the mind and sense organs, you know? It's trapped in the box. And so there has to be a teaching, you know, that will come and make that dream character recognize that, in fact, you are the whole. That you be the being that you are is the one from whom this whole has come. You are, in fact, Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishvara, but you are Ishvara because you are the Atma, you know, from which this whole creation is coming, you see?
Okay, I get very upset because I'm doing what you're saying, but with the mind, I'm trying to see, like,
self.
Okay, let's look at it this way then. It's all right to label it, because the mind's the great labeler. It just has to label properly. So look at it like this. When you say, I am my mind, I, the conscious being, am my mind. You can start there. Okay, that's true. There's a conscious me that is the very self of the mind. Now all you have to do is recognize that what I call me, the mind itself as a thought, is actually objectifiable and it comes and goes. So I can differentiate this me that is the very self of the mind and self-evident as consciousness. You don't need something to come in and light it up. I can differentiate this self from the mind which is changing, the one that illumines the mind. And then the mind can say, oh look, I'm changing, consciousness is not. It's making I'm changing, I the mind am changing, but the self, me, is not changing. The conscious being is not changing. And then the mind's just correctly labeling the reality. The reality is that the you that illumines the mind is stable. The mind is changing. Then the mind makes a comment on that. Oh, look. I, the thoughts are all changing. I, the conscious being, is not. And then the mind can ask, can I make the consciousness, me, the self, change? Then try. Try it with your mind. Try to influence or change or wobble, you know, or change the affect of consciousness. Change the nature of me with a mean thought or a sad thought or a happy thought. And recognize that you can't. You can't change your nature. Practice. But the more you practice, the more you recognize there's nothing I can do. And then while you're walking around and talking to your friends, you can continue practicing. Can I do anything? to alter or change or influence my own being.
It's kind of like living a double life there. Yeah.
You recognize that you become you recognize yourself as the constant no matter what the experience is. I'm still here as I am. Your mind is happy, your mind is sad, your mind is doing this, you're involved in that, talking with friends, you're watching TV, or whatever you're doing, doesn't make any difference. You are as you are. So you have to let the mind look for that, not look for it as an object, but recognize, differentiate the conscious you from the changing experiences. You don't have to illumine you as an object, because you're already consciousness. You're the luminary. You don't need a means of knowledge to light you up. You know, an example I like for that is when you're sitting in meditation, look at what you do. Shut your eyes, relax your body so you can't really feel it. Shut all your sense organs. Pull them in, relax your body so you can't feel it. Do some pranayama and breathing exercises, whatnot. Do some japa maybe and make your mind quiet. You're just shutting everything down. Right? You're shutting everything down. And so what happens? The more you shut down, the more you shine. Nothing shuts you down. You stop your mind and all of that. You're just then the one who's shining is just you. Right? You don't require anything or anyone or a mind or sense organs to light you up. You are the light. You're self-evident. That's what we mean by self-evident. You don't need another means of knowledge to come in and light you up. Right? And that self-evident one never changes at all. Ever. In any way. You can't make it change. So that's why it's good to try. The more you try, the more you realize, oh, I am indestructible. I am immutable. I can't hurt myself. You know, it was a big relief for me. Is all of that is nice, but it was great when I realized I can't improve myself. You can't make yourself worse. You can't hurt yourself. And you also can't make yourself better. So it's over, yeah. You know what I mean? Om. Om Tat Sat. You are what you are. And then you think, would I want myself to be different at all? These are all beautiful meditations where your mind is kind of asking analytical questions about your own experience, you know. What I want, could I improve my being? And the answer is no. But the answer is even, it's a bigger answer than no. It's almost the question itself doesn't apply. You know, it's just like the question, what color are you? What color is awareness? What color is your being? Is it brown or is it black or is it white? What color is it? And you ask, how big are you? Are you? Are you tall or you're short? Is awareness tall or short? The questions don't apply, right? And then if you ask, you know, would you like yourself to be different? You know, it isn't like that. The answer is no, I can't imagine how it could be different. It's more like this. It's a fun question to ask, you know, because the answer is, almost it's one of those questions that doesn't apply, but the answer is no. Because if it was different, it wouldn't be you. It wouldn't be you. And there's nothing more beloved to you than you. That's another thing to meditate on and understand, because that is the meaning of ananda. We say the Atma is ananda. Because there is nothing more beloved. That's the ananda. And that ananda is stable. That's not joy or bliss that comes and goes in the mind. That's you. The beloved nature of yourself that you don't ever want to go and get rid of. That's the ananda. It's all very nice. Well,
another class.
Another day.